It's 5:06 and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. Coming up in a half hour, we'll hear about whether we can hope for bipartisan deal-making in Congress in the new year.
But first, how often do you wish you had just the right tool for the right job or knew the right website to visit to find the info you need? Kevin Kelly has compiled and reviewed more than 1,500 tools, loosely defined, in one place. It's called Cool Tools, A Catalog of Possibilities. Kevin Kelly, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, it's my privilege.
Well, you founded, co-founded Wired Magazine. You're the editor and publisher of the Cool Tools website. You get a ton of traffic. What made you to decide to tackle this real printed on paper catalog?
Well, you know, for many, many years, we've been collecting these cool tool recommendations from users on the website, and they were becoming a little bit overwhelming. And it turns out that paper is actually very highly evolved to navigate you through lots of different choices. And when we published this and printed this on 500 pages of oversized paper, something magical happened. And while you're going through all this stuff, your brain is able to navigate through these things much better than you can on the web.
Cutting-edge technology, the catalog. I love it. Well, you've really stretched the idea of tool. If I think tool, an image of a wrench pops in my head. And you have that kind of hardware store stuff in there. But what makes the cut? What counts as a cool tool in your mind?
Broadly defined, a tool is anything that's handy. So, you know, of course, a phone app can be a tool as well as, you know, a wrench, but so can the proper chart on your wall that allows you to understand how history works. Or it can be a DVD that's a how-to explaining a way to make puppets using clay. Any kind of thing that's useful is a tool in my book.
And what that's the tool part. What's the cool part?
Cool means that either it's not well known or is just superior to anything else like it, or else there's nothing else like it, or else it's just the cheapest that's available, or else it's the best. So there's a sense in which these things are distinctive in the sense that they're cheaper, better, or just more different than anything else out there.
And how do you make the decision when you're shopping for a tool of whatever sort that this is the time to buy the cheap one, and this is the time to buy the best one, even if it costs a little more?
That's a really great question, because there are so many choices out there, and you're sometimes overwhelmed with the variety and the quality. Generally, what I advocate is something I call the highest common denominator, which is not the cheapest possible tool, nor the most expensive, but the highest quality in the middle that will get you to some standard that you know, you can use the tools for a while and then go on to something better if you use it a lot. But even before that, I recommend that people rent tools. There are a lot of places to rent tools, or you can subscribe to tools increasingly in the cities with an outfit called Tech Shop, where it's like a gym. You have your membership, and that allows you to use any of the latest and greatest tools that they have, and they have one of everything.
And that's things like makerspaces and hackerspaces too, right?
Exactly. They'll have laser cutters and 3D printers as well as, you know, your favorite skill saw. They'll have quilt makers and plasma jets, and you'll basically have the best workshop in the world. You don't need to keep it up. You don't need to repair anything. They'll do all that for you. And I think sometimes that's even better than buying the tool yourself.
One of my only trip to a hackerspace, one of our neighbors had a gingerbread house-making event, but they cut the gingerbread with a laser cutter that he'd programmed the patterns in. It was pretty cool, though the smell of charred gingerbread took a long time to leave my clothes and hair.
But actually, right now, the really cool thing in sewing is now cutting patterns and cloth using laser cutters. And I'd have to tell you that this is really going to transform sewing, because now you can get patterns customized to your body and just have it cut on a laser cutter really fast.
Cool. Well, I want to give people a sense of the range of tools you include. We wouldn't get to all of them if we were on the air for two more hours. But let's take a look at the category of orality. Things related to hearing is a good place to start for radio. You've got everything from a sturdy music stand to how to make do-it-yourself instruments. Can you tell us a couple of your favorites from that category?
Well, a route is anything that we can listen to. So it ranges from, you know, how to stream radio stations on your computer to even things like satellite phones. We all know cell phones, but if you're out in the middle of an expedition somewhere in the Sahara,
as I often am,
yes, of course, you want to be able to connect, and you can actually rent satellite phones for a week. And that's a great tool to know, so you can phone home. There are things like synthetic pianos, which are emulated on a laptop or on a machine, and they've been around for a long time, but these are now modeling the physics of the piano. They're just not sampled sounds. They're actually recreating the way that the strings inside move and vibrate, and you can even dial in like you want, whether you want a piano that's been played, you know, for like 100 years and it has that kind of a sound, or whether you want a broken piano. And so that kind of a synthetic piano, which was reviewed by a guy who made Myst computer game and did the soundtrack, that's a great tool to know about.
How about, do you have any favorites in the world of what we might think of tools that we use in a workshop or around the house? Do you have a couple favorites that you reviewed in the book?
Yeah, I tend to recommend things that are not electronic, not these kind of fancy things that are going to go obsolete. And a great example of that would be the Hokey carpet sweeper, which has been around for, I don't know, at least 5 decades, and this is a non-electric push carpet sweeper that all the restaurants use because it's quiet and it has no batteries and it always works, and it works very well. And you just push this thing really fast, and it cleans your carpet, and you put it away. So it's faster than a dustbuster, it's quieter than any vacuum, it's been around forever, it really works, and it's a great old tool.
So newer isn't always better.
No, not at all. And a lot of these things they have the same design, and they can keep increasing the quality of the parts and tweaking. And so you'll have things like another example of a tool that most people don't know, even though even these old geezers in the garage probably don't know about this one. It's called the grip hoist, and it was invented in Scandinavia, and it's like a come along, kind of like a winch that you use to draw things to you. But as you might know from a come-along, there's kind of a ratcheting gear that moves it along and prevents it from snapping back. But this grip hoist actually kind of has a kind of a hand-over-hand action inside, and so you can actually move several tons of weight with a millimeter precision because it's completely continuous. There's no ratcheting involved. And that's the kind of a tool that I think should be well better known.
And where do you see that in action? Is this something that a particular profession has embraced, or is it just a tool that time hasn't come yet?
Well, actually, it's used a lot in window washers who are raising themselves up windows in a kind of a scaffold that goes, it's pulled up. So they're hoisting themselves up a scaffolding. And they're doing it with great precision, with their own human power, and great safety. And that's one example where you see this used. Another example would be for erecting, say, a wind tower or solar panels or something heavy, where you want to move something really heavy, and you want to move it accurately and without auxiliary power.
We're talking to Kevin Kelly about his new book covering grip hoists and 1,000 and even more, hundreds of other tools. The book is Cool Tools, A Catalog of Possibilities.
And we would love to hear from you. What is the coolest tool that you use regularly? Or is there a tool that you wish you could find but you haven't been able to locate it yet? Well, Kevin Kelly might just have an idea for you. Or perhaps you've invented a tool that ought to be in this book. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now with Kevin Kelly. His new book is Cool Tools, A Catalog of Possibilities. It reviews and recommends hundreds and hundreds of different tools, broadly defined, something you might find in a hardware store, something you might find on your smartphone, books, CDs, a whole bunch of other stuff. And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Is there a tool that does the job so perfectly you couldn't live without it? Tell us about it. Or is there a gap? Is there a tool you wish existed but you don't know about it? Call us at 800-642-1234 or send us an email, talk@wpr.org. We'll go to the phones now. We have Sam on the line in Milwaukee. Sam, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how's it going?
Really good. What's your question?
I am an arborist, so I'm wondering if he has any recommendations in the realm of chainsaws. I'm very familiar with chainsaws. Just wondering if there's anything better out there or in the realm of ascending a rope. I'm frequently climbing up a rope to get into a tree. Just wondering if there's any new interesting tools to use for that.
All right. Thanks for the call, Sam. Any suggestions, Kevin?
Since he sounds like a professional, I don't think I could tell him anything he doesn't know, but we still recommend some of the skill saws, which are old standbys. But there is something that most people who use a chainsaw in their backyard don't know about, which is they really should be wearing a face mask, and the kind of a face mask that has a little bit of a screen guard on it. That's just for safety reasons, and we recommend that people use that while they're chainsawing, not just their goggles, but actually a face mask that will protect their face from a kickback.
I was going to say I've used goggles and some pretty flimsy ones at that, that I've like, this really isn't going to help me much, probably.
No. But the face mask and helmet with earmuffs will actually protect your face in case. And there are safety guards on the newest chainsaws, but you really have only one face you want to protect.
Fair enough. Well, good luck, Sam. And we'll go now to Jeff in Antioch, Illinois. Jeff, hi.
Hi. How are you?
I'm good. What's your question or recommendation for us?
Well, you asked about inventors. I invented a tool. I took out a patent on it. It's in my opinion, it's pretty darn cool. It's something that'll attach to a hand level. You can take a two-footer and turn it into a four-footer. It's got a telescoping, rod that comes out, and you can stop it anywhere between that 2 foot and 4 foot. Which, if you're hanging some shelves tight between two walls or something, it can be a real handy tool.
That sounds great, Jeff. Kevin, what do you think of that? And also, I assume you like that kind of do-it-yourself, make-up-the-tool-you-need instinct there.
Absolutely. We're very much in the mode of recommending that people make as many of the tools as they need, particularly to solve a problem that there's no tool for right now. His idea sounds great. We do recommend other kinds of tools for leveling and hanging pictures, and including one that you can actually move some sliders in between to get 2 points on a picture hung level, which is actually trickier than it sounds.
Yes, it is.
It is. And so he should send us a note about his tool, and maybe it will become a cool tool in the future.
All right. What's the Cool Tools website? Is it cooltools.com? I don't have that right in front of me.
Yeah, it's cool-tools.com.
.org. Okay, Jeff, you can check them out there and maybe share your level invention there. Thanks a lot for your call. I wanted to get into some of the social tools you have. You've got a whole category of that, things like street smarts, practical politics, and I want to hear about this one, Hive Mind, trying to tap into the power not of the internet, but of the people who use the internet to get answers you need.
So one of the tools that I actually recommend is very useful if you're trying to make things happen is a site, but it's more like an institution called Meetup. And this makes it very easy for you to gather like-minded people about whatever it is that you are interested in, whether it's a hobby or a cause
or some kind of an interest. And this system, which you use online, can manage the invites, it can manage who's showing up, it can manage whether you want to direct people or charge people for coming. And it's very, very useful, and I've used it several times for the kinds of things that I've been interested in starting. So you go to Meetup, and then here is a tool that will make it easier for you to gather people around a particular interest. That's very powerful.
And it could be a product, or it could be a cause, I imagine, or
yes,
I guess the sky's the limit, right?
Yeah, so there's people who have meetups based around the fact that they like a certain kind of dog breed, and they want to get together with other people. So you're meeting face-to-face. This is all to enable face-to-face meeting. It's not about online meetings. It's about organizing something in your local area. Or you may have enthusiasm for a particular kind of book, or you may have maybe it is a cause where you're trying to save a particular wilderness area or something. All these, doesn't really matter. It's agnostic about what the interest is. It just enables you to very easily find and gather and coordinate people to meet, and then you can kind of rate it afterwards. People rate it afterwards, and those meetings that were successful, next time you have an invitation, you can see, last time, was it fun for people? Were they informed? Did it work? Was the host, including everybody, all these kinds of things.
We'll go back to our callers now. We have Doug in Mount Horeb. Doug, hi, you're on the air.
I recommend the Yankee Drill. It's been around for 100 years or more. They stopped production in the United States. It's made in Germany. Now it's carried back in the U.S. again by Garrett Wade. It doesn't have a power cord. It doesn't have a battery pack. You operate it with one hand. It carries its own bits. It's just a great little carpenter's tool. You can slip it into your pocket when you're walking around. You push on it, and it cuts in, it drills in one direction. When you take the pressure off your hand, it reverses and cuts in the other direction. And it's self-lubricating, self-guiding, and it's just a great little tool. You can even slip it inside your shirt pocket.
Doug, thanks. The Yankee push drill, and I'm glad. I was worried there if it was the Yankee drill was just made in Germany now. It sounds like it's back to the United States. Is that one you're familiar with, Kevin?
Absolutely. Everything he says is absolutely 100% true, and it is exactly why it's included in our catalog of cool tools, because it's an analog version, and oftentimes for 80% of your drilling household needs, you can use a drill like this. And you can hand it down to the next generation, your children and grandchildren as well.
All right. Thanks, Doug. And we've got Keith in Appleton now. Hi, Keith.
Hi. I'd like to throw my 2 cents worth in. The Craig jig I found to be absolutely awesome. It does so much, and if anyone's familiar with them, it makes cabinets. It puts wood together in a straight board to make a door. It's a great little tool.
A Craig jig. How do you spell Craig in this instance?
K-R-E-G.
All right.
Craig.
Thanks, Keith. The Craig jig, Kevin.
I'm not sure I'm familiar with the Craig jig. We do have a number of jigs that other people have recommended for cabinet making, like chores where you're trying to make a drawer or line something up. And I should emphasize that this catalog was written by the readers. So it's not something that I have written all the reviews of. They're enthusiasts who have a passion for something like the caller, and they have submitted and recommended this tools, and so I'm not familiar with it, but doesn't mean it's not really great. You can look on our website, which is out there, to see if Craig is listed. But there are other jigs like that for drilling holes, blind holes, etc. I should probably check out this one and see if it's worthy of cool tools.
Kevin, in our last minute or so, is there something that's maybe new to you, maybe even since the publication of Cool Tools, the catalog, that you're going nuts for and is changing your life?
Well, there was something actually during the Christmas season that was a really great tool. It was a website called Retail Me Not, and it was kind of a user-credentialed site that would tell you about whether there was a discount coupon if you're going to buy something online. And they were actually vetted by the user, so it would not only tell you whether it was there, but what percent chance you had that it would actually work. And it's a site that I now go to first whenever I'm going to buy something online outside of Amazon, because generally I would say, you know, 90% of the time there is a discounted coupon that you can actually use to save shipping or whatever.
But that gets you away from the ones that kind of just get you in the door,
yeah,
but don't really do anything.
Right. Right, right. These are there's no mess, no fuss, none of this kind of scamming stuff. It's actually used and vetted and reviewed by other people, so you know what's going to happen.
Well, Kevin, we're out of time. Thanks for joining us, and I hope you'll come back again and share some more tools with us in the future.
I would love to, and I just would encourage everybody not to buy tools. This is a tool that will show you what is out there. You don't have to buy everything, but you should know that they exist.
That's Kevin Kelly. He's Senior Maverick at Wired Magazine. His new book, Cool Tools, A Catalog of Possibilities.
Coming up after the news, we'll be taking a look at the prospects for bipartisanship in Congress in the new year. And then on Food Friday, we'll hear how soup can bring communities together. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
There's been a lot of conflict and a lot of partisanship in Congress over the last year. Our next guest says the budget deal reached by Congressman Paul Ryan and Senator Patty Murray could provide a model for getting things done in 2014.
G. William Hoagland joins us now. He's Senior Vice President at the Bipartisan Policy Center, a longtime congressional staffer. Bill, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon. Good to be with you, Rob.
In a piece you co-wrote this week in the Christian Science Monitor, you say the key to that Ryan-Murray budget deal was that both sides were willing to hold their noses and pass this thing. Why is that the key?
Right. Well, I think the bottom line is that we haven't been able to accomplish a great deal in terms of congressional action over the last many years. In fact, quite frankly, we haven't been able to do a budget resolution for the last 4 years. And I think that the point has come to where when you have a divided Congress, a Senate under one party control and a House under another, and it's the only way you can get anything done is to compromise. And while neither side got what they wanted totally, at least they were able to find some way of splitting the issues and getting to a point where they could actually do something and move forward with a budget. Nobody likes the compromise, I guess, when you're a partisan. But in this particular case, a lot of credit goes to Chairman Murray and Chairman Ryan for at least finding something that was good to middle ground to move Congress forward on putting together a budget that hopefully will avoid a government shutdown here in January and move us forward to maybe doing some other things on a bipartisan basis in 2014.
Well, speaking of the shutdown, this deal came just a couple of months after the fall shutdown. Did that jolt people on both sides into saying, hey, maybe we don't need to hold quite so firm on principle and be more willing to compromise?
Oh, I think it had a big effect, particularly on the Republican Party in the House and in the Senate. I think the bottom line there was that people held Congress and particularly held Republicans accountable for the shutdown and basically blamed everybody, including the president and the Democratic-controlled Senate. And so this was a move. The shutdown probably provided some incentive for let's do something. Let's show the American public that even in a divided Congress, we can still do something. And again, I would want to emphasize this is not this is not something that's a great deal in terms of a deficit reduction. In fact, in the near term, quite frankly, it adds slightly to the deficit. But it did show that Republicans and Democrats could come together on something to keep government open, hopefully here in January, and move forward and fight on the issues later on. But at the same time, that there is a way to find middle ground on very difficult issues.
You worked on Capitol Hill for a long time. Were things different, and if so, why? Why was compromise more possible back then and not now?
Oh, that's, of course, one likes to think that things were always better in the past. and maybe that's true. I think there was we didn't have quite the degree of partisanship. There was fights. We had difficult fights. I worked for Republicans that fought with Democrats But at the same time, there was a willingness to come and recognize that at the end of the day, you had to set aside your very partisan positions for the good of the country. And if that meant compromise, compromise was not a four-letter word. It was a good outcome, and if so long as it kept things, people without having to overly compromise their positions, it was we were willing to work together. Was it different in the past? I will only point out that we've had real divisions in this country. Let's just not forget about 150 years ago when the country was very divided. So it's not like we haven't had difficulties with finding a middle ground, but I think it's been very difficult over the last 5-10 years. It's been extremely difficult to find a middle ground when you have a divided Congress. I don't want to say that things are necessarily any better or worse. I do think that there was a willingness amongst the leadership in the past to sit down, work with the president, and find middle ground that hasn't been there, quite frankly. And I think it's a pox on both houses, both Democrats and Republicans, for their some partisanships that have been existed over the last few years.
It seems like there's a basic conflict when you get elected. On one hand, people want you to stand your ground, hold firm to principles, fight for what you believe in and what the people who agree with you believe in. But there's also an ideal of somebody who's willing to cooperate and compromise and make things work. You worked in Congress a lot. How do elected officials strike that balance?
It's very difficult. You're absolutely correct. You fight, you hold your position as long as you can. But you do not take yourself over the cliff at the point where you recognize that you are an elected official for the United States and the United States totally, not just for your district, not just for your individual state, but you're working. You are a United States representative. You're a United States senator. When you recognize that what you're there for is to find that middle ground, that common ground for the good of the nation, I think you recognize you have to find compromise. You have to find a way to reach across the aisle. You've taken as far as you can. You've argued your position as long as you can. But at some point, you have to come to grips with the fact that the other person may have a point of view also, that you have to find some way of working together to move forward for the betterment of the country in total. And that, it's hard. I'm not going to suggest in any way, shape, or form that it's not difficult on these members, and particularly on their parties and their constituents back home, and they are held accountable. But at the end of the day, statesmanship comes forward, and they do what is right for the country.
Looking ahead to 2014, what kind of deals do you think there could be that maybe modeled on the Ryan Murray budget deal that passed this month?
Well, again, each individual issue that comes up will be fought hard on both sides. First of all, I would expect that when the Congress returns in January, that the first issue will be that they'll have to deal with what we call the appropriation bill that will keep government funded. There'll be resistance to this, and this will be the first implementation of the agreement that Ryan and Murray reached. That will be difficult, but I think that will show that at the end of the day they can move forward. More importantly, the next step will be the Farm Bill, and I think the Farm Bill is on its way to becoming a law of the land, and it again will show that people have had to move off of their maybe hard-pressed positions to find the middle ground. Finally, I think it's still possible, though this will be a heavier lift, on immigration reform. I think there is a good indication that Speaker Boehner wants to find some approach to immigration issues, and I think that also is possible in 2014. Accomplishing all of that and then doing what we call getting ready for the fiscal year 2015 appropriation bills is another major effort which will take place, but it'll be focused primarily on the agreement that was just reached because it sets the levels of funding for 2015. If we accomplish all that in a midterm election year, I think that will be considered somewhat of a success for the 212th Congress.
Bill, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Bill Hoagland. He's Senior Vice President at the Bipartisan Policy Center. We've got a link to his Christian Science Monitor piece on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. It's winter in Wisconsin, the time of year where a lot of us are ready to, well, just hibernate in our homes and just stir for a warm, hearty meal every now and again.
And a lot of us turn to soup for those meals, but our next guest says it's a meal that's best enjoyed with other people. And she says hosting soup nights can be an incredible way to bring people together and create a sense of community.
Maggie Stuckey is a writer and author. Her new book is Soup Night, Recipes for Creating Community Around a Pot of Soup. Maggie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, tell us about this idea of soup nights and how you got into them.
Well, I was invited to attend one at my hometown of Portland, Oregon. This is a soup night that's been going on. By the time I first met them, they'd been going on for about 5 years. It is all the families on one block, corner to corner on both sides of the street. They get together once a month. One family volunteers to be the host for that month, and they make two big pots of soup, one of which is vegetarian. And they serve soup and bread, and people sometimes bring other things, but that's not part of the deal. Their whole focus is, this is a very urban neighborhood with all the demographic variables that you would kind of expect in a big city. And there was a feeling by a couple of the families when their kids were really young, that they wanted the children to be able to go outside in the front yard and play and be kids and not be afraid. Not if there was somebody coming down the sidewalk, they wouldn't have to have that moment of panic of, you know, whether that person's going to represent some kind of threat. They would know that it's a friend because they'd seen them around the neighborhood and they knew them on a real basis. And this one mom was just trying to imagine how they could create that kind of environment. And the idea that she came up with is, let's just make a giant pot of soup and invite everybody and see what happens. And what's happened is that they have created an unbelievable real community on this one block. It's like a little small town smack in the middle of a big city. They're all very different from each other. They wouldn't naturally form any kind of connection or bonds of friendship because they have so many different interests and different ways of living their life. And yet, because they get together once a month and they have this meal together, they all kind of know each other in a really special small town kind of way. It's absolutely amazing and wonderful to watch.
So this was actually formed with the intent of trying to bring the neighborhood together.
Yeah.
Did it work?
Very, very, very deliberate intent. And the reason that it works is they all made a commitment to be inclusive. They invite everybody. I mean, it's real easy to have a party when you invite people you already know. And that's fun. And, you know, nobody's saying don't do that. But if your goal is to get people to know each other, then you have to include everybody.
And did it work from the get-go? I mean, did it just take off and keep going?
It did. It absolutely was so important that they this neighborhood also has a block party in the late summertime. And it's so easy, it's so popular that all they do is somebody puts out a sign-up sheet at the block party, and people get into arguments because they enjoy it so much. They want to make sure that they get to do it. So the sign-up sheet fills up in about 10 minutes, and that's all there is. It's so easy. Part of the reason it works is it's easy. All you do is you make the soup, and you probably send out a kind of an information sheet, either by email. Sometimes people do a small flyer, and the kids, you know, go up and down the street and hand it out. One of the things about this particular soup night, and I actually found this in several other places, is one of their goals is that whoever is the host that night shouldn't be burdened with any extra work, including dishwashing afterwards.
Nice.
So part of the deal is you bring your own soup bowl and spoon and then take it back home with you. And so the first night I was ever there on this block, I stood on my brother's front porch and I watched this lovely parade of people going down the sidewalk and everybody's carrying an empty soup bowl. It's absolutely charming.
That's great. Now, you mentioned elsewhere. Is this an idea that's picking up outside of Portland where it sounds like it started?
It very much is. With when I started to really explore this and to look into it somewhat, I very easily found almost 50 different neighborhood groups around the country. I should say different groups. Most of them are neighborhoods, but sometimes they are organizations that aren't a geographic neighborhood, who host some kind of regular event, all with the same goal and all with the same mechanism. They did somehow it's a soup, it's a meal about soup, and every one of these groups has the same purpose, which is using it as a way to get people to know each other better. 30 of those groups are profiled in the book, and they are all over the country, literally coast to coast. And the really cool thing about this is every soup group I found is in a big city. I didn't find any in the suburbs. I mean, maybe people in the suburbs already know each other, but I would think, just if I hadn't had this opportunity to speak to all these people, that people in big cities have a tendency to kind of want to stay inside and just be kind of socially closed in and keep to themselves and just a few close friends. But in fact, these people all have exactly the opposite. They wanted to know their neighbors. They wanted to reach outward and build a community. And it is so wonderful to talk to them. They are so proud of what they've accomplished. They love to talk about it. They love to show it off. They're so excited when somebody comes to visit from out of state and it happens to be on a soup night. You know, they always go, they tell their, you know, mom and dad visiting from back home, you got to come and see this. You're just going to love it.
And we want to get into some of the recipes in a second or two, but I want to talk about the whole soup premise first of all. Would this have worked as well, do you think, if it were, you know, pizza night or cheeseburger night or something like that?
I think it would have worked almost as well, because the whole thing is, you know, to get people mm-hmm. together. First of all, when you get people sitting around a table and sharing a meal together, something good is going to happen. But I have concluded, having watched this over a couple of years now, that the soup itself adds an almost magical quality, because there's something about the soup as a dish. It's warm, it's comforting, it's nourishing. I mean, when we all remember when we were kids and we were sick, Mom brought up a bowl of chicken noodle soup and we instantly felt better. Soup just makes you feel better on so many levels, and it's. I was at a soup night once when I was watching a couple of people who don't know each other, but they were sitting opposite each other on the table, and they both had their hands around the bowl, kind of warming their hands, and they would lean in and they smell how wonderful the soup smells, and then they made eye contact and they realized they were both kind of doing the same thing, and they smiled at each other, and that's the beginning of a relationship.
I want to spend our last couple minutes talking about the soup itself now.
Okay.
Can you give us a couple of your favorite? You divide it up by season. Can you hit us with a couple great winter soup ideas that we can use here in a cold month in Wisconsin?
Isn't it great soup weather, boy?
It is. It is.
One of my favorites, and it's my favorite for several reasons. One, it's very inexpensive, and you almost always have the ingredients on hand. Is African peanut soup, which is basically a rice, tomato, chicken stock, or vegetable stock, but it has a good big spoonful of peanut butter in it, mm-hmm. which adds protein if you choose to make it a vegetarian version, and adds this kind of a mysterious flavor that nobody can really identify, and they end up saying, what is it that I'm tasting? And when I say peanut butter, they don't believe it, but it's really, really wonderful. There's a number of soups that use kind of good leftovers, like some people still have their leftover turkey stock from Thanksgiving, maybe. Turkey and bean, and turkey and kale and bean. It's almost like asking a parent which is your favorite child. There's 99 soup recipes in the book, and I have to say I enjoy them all.
So let's say that somebody wanted to start their own soup night in whatever town or city that they live in. How do you get started doing that?
Well, if you're in a neighborhood, that's kind of the easiest way to think about it. Maybe you're going to go your whole block or your cul-de-sac if your neighborhood is organized that way. The very best thing to do, pick a night. Early Sunday evening seems to work well for people, and a good time frame so that people know there's a definite thing they can think about in terms of time. I'm going to say, let's say 6 to 8 or 5 to 7. So it's going to be a school night, so there's still time for kids to get organized for school tomorrow. For the first time, the person who's doing it should be the host, and because then they can explain what the idea is. And go to every house, have a small handout ready to leave if people are not home, kind of explaining the idea. I found it works really well if two people go together, so that you choose as your partner somebody who knows the folks that you do not know. So between the two of you, you will know almost everybody. And then you just sort of introduce yourself. Hi, we're having soup at my house this coming Sunday. Hope you can come. Here's some information about it. I talked to a woman a while ago who told me about her experiences starting up, and she said, I never had anybody say to me, go away.
That's great. Maggie, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
That's Maggie Stuckey. She's the author of Soup Nights, Recipes for Creating Community Around a Pot of Soup.